Welcome to another episode of the Greg McKeown Podcast, where we explore, of course, the disciplined pursuit of less but better. I'm Greg McKeown, the author of Essentialism and of Effortless, and I have the distinct pleasure of introducing a guest whose work exemplifies the very essence of what we discuss here. Joining us is Lydie Klotz, a trailblazer in the world of behavioral science and a master of the art of subtraction. As a professor at the University of Virginia, Lydie has carved a niche in understanding how our decisions can be shaped for greater sustainability, efficiency, and overall impact by the simple yet profound act of subtracting. Lydie's book, Subtract: The Untapped Science of Less, challenges this conventional add more mentality and opens our eyes to the power not only of less exactly, but simplification in general. His insights have not only revolutionized approaches in design, but some invaluable lessons for everyday lives. In today's conversation, we will delve into how subtracting rather than adding can lead to more meaningful and effective outcomes. It's about redefining our understanding of value, of efficiency in a world that often emphasizes more, ever so more, more of the time. So get ready to unlearn and relearn with us as we explore the untapped science of less with the insightful Lydie Klotz. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Greg. Great to be here. I love that you said unlearn, right? That's an element of subtracting, and that's a hard one. So nice.
Just launch us into this subject. Help us see why you thought it was important enough to write about subtraction that you invested all of that energy that you did into writing this book. Why?
Yeah, I've been interested in, you know, Essentialism. I read Essentialism, for example, and it's one of those books that, you know, continues to shape my life. And, you know, you can't even say, oh, it's, you know, this thing from Essentialism. It's just one of those things that, you know, kind of shapes your thinking. And also my interest in sustainability. But I think if there's a moment when I started to focus on subtraction, this act of subtraction, it was playing Legos with he's nine now, but he was three at the time, my son Ezra. And the basic issue that we had was we were making a bridge out of Legos. And one of the support columns was longer than the other support column. So me using a little bit of my engineering background, I'm like, I can do this. I'm going to be a good dad here. And I turned around behind me to get a block to add to the shorter column. And by the time I had turned back around, Ezra had removed a block from the longer column. And that was like, okay, cool. Because, you know, I was so enamored with the end state, right? This end state of elegance or simplicity. And what that showed me in the moment was that, well, there's this step that it takes often to get there, which is subtracting. And that seems to be something we've since done a ton of research to help, you know, understand that it's actually true. It's more than just an anecdote from my son, that when we're presented with a situation that we want to make better, whether it's that Lego bridge or whether it's our calendar or whether it's our, you know, our organization, we tend to think of what we can add first and therefore, and then move on without even considering this whole other class of options.
Love that anecdote because it does so simply explain this default tendency we have to solve by addition. And it's not that you're saying you can't solve by addition. Obviously, you can. One of the sections of your book is emphasizing that. Add and subtract. You know, the idea of, I think it's under the section called expand. But nevertheless, the default always to addition means that we miss, well, perhaps it is 50% of the solutions. You mentioned there that you've done additional research. Can you share a specific item of research that you've done and published that has explained this tendency?
Yeah, well, I'll share the most, I think the most convincing for me, but it's abstract. And if you want a more applied example, I'll give that after. But so, I mean, we studied this in a whole bunch of ways. One of criticism of all the different ways you could study something is something that you might be thinking of with the Legos, which is like, well, that's just what we've learned to do with Legos, right? And so we eventually came to this study setup where we're giving people grid patterns on a computer screen. And the basic setup of these grid patterns were there were four different quadrants. And the task that people had to do was to make the pattern symmetrical from left to right and top to bottom. And we'd present them with like pre-filled blocks. And the way to, you could make this symmetrical by adding blocks to three quadrants or subtracting blocks from one quadrant. That was the basic setup. So so now you've got a situation where there are people are literally getting the answer wrong because they want to add, right? So they're adding in three quadrants, even though subtracting from one quadrant is the simpler way to solve the problem, which is what we test them to do it as simply as possible. So people are solving this, right? And sure enough, they add more often than they subtract. And then, you know, so that's the most convincing specific demonstration, but then you can run all kinds of iterations on that to see like, okay, is this, are they doing this because it's a default, right? Or a heuristic, which you mentioned. And so knowing about heuristics, it's like, okay, what is our brain to go to first? It's not that we can't think of other things. It's just that that's our default, right? And so the theory there would be, okay, well, if you're overloaded, if you're overworked, if you're thinking about other things, you're going to be even more likely to rely on the heuristics, right? Mm-hmm. So now you've got this grid study and you can do another iteration of it where we're like, well, let's put a scroll of numbers across the bottom of the screen and people have to click on the numbers to click an F every time a five goes by. So they're basically texting when driving or trying to multitask. And then they became even more likely to add, right? So it's, you know, kind of convincing evidence. Number one, that we don't think of it even when it's the right answer.
In our favor.
And that it seems to be because it's just, you know, our heuristic, our default is to think about adding first.
What is the name of the first piece of research that you did? Is this the why our brains miss opportunities to improve through subtraction?
So the best, the paper is on people systematically overlook subtractive changes. And that was in Nature, which is like the pinnacle of academic's career. It was on the cover actually. So that is where all the studies are described. And I mean, for a academic article, it is very easy to understand. We put a lot of work into, and the editors of Nature put a lot of work into making it, you know, easy to follow.
Yeah. The name of it was People Systematically Overlook Opportunities to Subtract. Was that the name?
People Systematically Overlook Subtractive Changes.
Subtractive Changes. That's a nice term. Okay. So I love that. Build it from there for us, because that is interesting. A heuristic, a default tendency to look for addition even when subtraction would be more optimal. And then adding to that, this idea that when you're overwhelmed, when you have more data coming at you, when you're in a VUCA environment of volatility and uncertainty and ambiguity, and constant change, you would even more fall into that heuristic. Is that just because we always fall more into whatever our default deep programming mindset is when we're faced with strain and stress?
Yeah. I mean, the you're just kind of going with your automatic thinking. But I love that you hit that already, right? Because sometimes it takes a really long time to get to, well, yeah, this is a really problematic feedback loop, right? Because the very thing we need to relieve the complex, you know, stressful, all this information coming at us is we become less likely to do it the more information we have coming at us. So it's this reinforcing feedback loop. But if you can interrupt it, you can kind of move it in the other direction.
Yeah, it's a it's a doom loop, right? Like we could call it an ever increasing momentum towards addition.
I think if you look at that, I mean, so we're talking about it at the cognitive scale level, right? But if you look at some of the things that everybody recognizes are bloated, like legislation, for example. I mean, there's like 17 times more legislation now than there was in 1950. And it's, you know, people, it's just the system that adds more than it subtracts, right? And part of it is not thinking of it. Part of it is, you know, not being able to follow through with the subtractions. But you can think about that in, you know, if your workplace, right, all the things that people complain about, why are we still doing this? You know, a lot of it is just, you know, kind of a product of this system that is distorted in that way.
17 times more legislation than when?
I think 1950. I did the calculation in the book. So it was when I wrote the book, so a few years back. But yeah, so and this is US, but I think it, like the Code of Federal Regulations in 1950 versus the Code of Federal Regulations now, and it's like 17 times larger now. And that, you know, that exceeds the rate of economic growth over that time.
I'm absolutely thrilled that Harvard Business Review is sponsoring this episode, because I go to hbr.org really frequently. I mean, literally just yesterday, looking up an article called Relearning the Art of Asking Questions, because I'm researching questions right now. And one of the things that I have found is that when we're very little, age 2 to 5, we ask questions incessantly, as much as 200 to 300 questions a day. And not surprisingly, the amount that we learn in that period of time is exceptional. It reduces significantly as we go to school, where suddenly we're incentivized to come up with the right answers rather than to continue developing the ability to ask the right questions. This is just one way in which I've been able to utilize HBR.org recently. So while much of Harvard Business Review's content is available for free after signing up at their site, subscriptions to unlimited content start at only $10 a month. Go to www.hbr.org/subscriptions and enter the promo code Greg right now to get 10% off your subscription. Again, to save 10% off your HBR subscription, go to www.hbr.org/subscriptions and enter promo code Greg. This episode is sponsored by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. So whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person point of sale system, whenever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. So sell more with less effort, thanks to Shopify Magic, which is your AI-powered all-star. In my experience with every business that I have built, including this podcast, there are breakthrough moments, and those moments are often the result of finding the right partner. And I think that's a way to think about Shopify, because no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Greg, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/Greg now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Greg. Does it come down to a sort of incentive problem that you get rewarded for adding, and there doesn't seem to be, at least there isn't a normal social process where you get rewarded for having eliminated a piece of legislation? Like, you don't hold although you could. So it's not like I necessarily think you couldn't create those kinds of things, but they don't exist normally. And so you don't have a normal celebratory cycle. So yeah, is it incentives, or is it, what is it really?
I love the words you're using. I mean, celebratory cycle. Like, I've tried to explain that to organizations that I talk to, and I'm going to use that term. I'll give you credit, but it's like, that's exactly it, right? I mean, so let me, this, I promise this will come back to the celebratory cycle, but like one of the cool things about finding a heuristic is then you can say, well, okay, why has this happened? Why has this evolved over time? And one of the places that you go to are biological reasons, right? And you can think of biological reasons why we might add more than we subtract, a lot of them around food and, you know, stockpiling supplies and goods. But another one that is surprisingly biological is just this desire to display competence, right? And the famous example is the bowerbirds. And these are the male bowerbirds will go around and build these ceremonial nests. And then the female bowerbirds go and look at the ceremonial nests and decide which male to mate with based on the nests. And that all kind of makes sense so far. But then the female bowerbird goes and builds a nest to actually raise the young. So the whole point of the male-built nest is just to show that this male bird can move sticks around in the world. And you know, the thought being that, okay, well, if those genes can move the sticks around, then those would be good genes for the kid to have. And so this is this desire to show that we can interact with the world. And it's one of the most robust findings in, you know, psychology, that we all share this. It's not just bowerbirds and it's not just males. And we do it not just through moving physical things around in the world, but through task completion, right? So now we're back to the celebratory cycle. It's really easy to celebrate a completed task. Now, of course, we're going to say like subtraction is also a completed task, but there's oftentimes not any evidence of it, right? When you add the legislation or when you add the new rule or when you add the employee or when you add 100 more words to a piece of writing, there's evidence and there's something that you can celebrate and there's something that's displaying your competence. When you take those things away, I mean, you need to be more intentional about creating the celebratory cycle. So you're right, it's not that we can't do it, but it's not gonna happen without being smart about how you build that in.
Yeah, the idea of a simplification reward is an interesting thought experiment. And, you know, can you do it? What do you mean by it? You know, it's a non-trivial challenge, because despite the word simplify and simplification, these words, because they are describing something inherently simple,
right,
obviously simple, that takes us away from the idea that actually simplicity is a really complex subject. Because we're not, I mean, okay, fine. You could say, well, let's simplify by the thoughtless elimination of everything. Okay, well, fine. I mean, that's simple. That's like a simple way to get to simplicity, oversimplifying it. But to really figure out how to take something, make it better but simpler, it's an interesting problem to solve. One of the examples that you cite in the book that I really loved was from Pennsylvania, Anna Kishlin. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so she's just an amazing person. Around, you know, born around 1900 or so, and she's ended up being the first registered woman architect in Pennsylvania. She volunteered for service during World War I. There's these great like archival documents of her saying like, "Yeah, I'm happy to serve, but could you give me something a little more dangerous, perhaps?" But and she was also kind of a serial inventor on the side. And her best known invention, or the one probably that influences us the most today, is called the K-brick. And so, what it effectively is the predecessor to the hollowed out masonry block that looks like a squared off figure eight that you see today. And so, before Anna Kishlin, the blocks were solid, right? Okay, this is working great for a long time. And, you know, she realized that one way to make blocks better was to remove parts of them. And, you know, not only did it made the blocks lighter, it made them, you know, perform just as well, make them easier to move around. I think there's an insight there a little bit. The reason she thought of it is because she really observed workers using the blocks, and she realized that this would be easier for them. But so it's just better in all these ways. And for the history of innovation in this very basic thing, literally a building block. Nobody thought of it until, or nobody executed it, I guess, until she came along. So I think, you know, one lesson is like how powerful it can be, but also, you know, when everybody else is overlooking something, there's real power for people who can use it, right? You're exploiting this opportunity and this inefficiency in the market of improvement, basically.
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge. You know, when I think about what she did, this innovation through simplification, it shows, it's a tangible example that you obviously, one, can do it, and secondly, that therefore you can also celebrate it, because right. That's tangible, that's real, and here we are celebrating it, and maybe not that many people, it may be outside of architecture or invention, or maybe, you know, maybe the suffragette movement, maybe they haven't heard of Anna Kiechelin, but still there's plenty of people that have. And so it's an illustration, a hopeful illustration, that you can get to the point where you culturally reinforce simplification. That there are lots of other examples, right? I mean, well, I'm actually, this is one of the curiosities about this to me, because the most valuable company in the world has demonstrated that there is an actual addition in value to people that can be measured. You know, that you know, I'm talking about Apple, and yeah. So it's so odd to me, or at least it was at first when I was seeing this. And then I said, well, why aren't other companies doing this? Why doesn't everybody just say, let's go for innovation through simplification? Look over there. Mm-hmm. It's incredible the value you're able to produce. Why do you think people aren't just doing that? Why don't they copy that strategy? It's so established now through the company of Apple.
I'd be interested what you think too, but one of my theories is that the end state of simplification, it distracts people from the fact that this is actually going to be to do. And I don't mean like significantly harder, but when you're adding, we've just seen just cognitively, right? Adding comes to mind automatically. It's not that we can't think about subtraction. You just have to, you know, remind yourself, or, you know, have a good disciplined problem solving approach, right? So it's a little bit harder cognitively. And then when it comes to, you know, things in the real world, physical things, subtracting is more steps, right? Because to take something away, you have to have added in the first place. And I think that the building block is an interesting example, right? That's working okay. Everything's fine. We're just trying to make it better by taking something away. So, you know, it's not that this end state of simplicity in the case of subtraction was actually easier to get to. In fact, it was harder to get to. It was more cognitive steps, and it's more kind of steps in the real world. And, you know, I think that's something that, I mean, obviously Apple appreciates. I talked to another company, a speaker company, and they were saying, I mean, they got this. They said when they went to just take a component away from one of their tried and true designs, they budgeted more design time for it than if you add something. And basically because the taking something away, now you have to see how it interacts with the whole system. When you add something, they're like, okay, we basically know that this isn't going to make anything worse, and we can just evaluate the additional added benefit. So I think in some ways people kind of underestimate how challenging it's going to be. And I know that, I mean, your second book, Effortless, you know, that's one of the lessons, right? Is that this is, yes, it ends up making your life easier, but you have to be disciplined to get to it, right? You have to do maybe some extra planning work to get to it.
So now that you've mentioned that, let's just put that into context, right? If you had to summarize essentialism in a single word, you could say it's about focus. And if you summarize effortless in a single word, then it's simplification. And that's not a bad way. That's not a bad way to think about it. And I think one of the most important ideas in Effortless is the principle of building systems that make execution effortless.
Right.
And so, yes, in exactly what you're saying, that you invest perhaps a little more upfront, but your return on effort, not just your return on investment, but your return on effort, your ROE, is much higher over time because you've built something. And that's what you're saying here, is that simplification in this sense is whatever the people that produce a complex product do, and then you keep going.
Exactly. Yeah. Keep going is the perfect way. Right. It's past it. It's past the complexity. You got to go past it. And that's just more work. It's more time, more thought, but it's fun. I mean, I don't like when I think about this when writing, right? It's like you've got, when you have the manuscript and now you're editing, I mean, I find that maybe not everybody likes it, but I find that a much more engaging challenge. And I think it's the same way when I think about design, right? You know that it basically works and now you're tinkering, trying to make it even better. It's just, I think it can be fun, even though it's more work.
Yeah, right. So that's one challenge, right? It's that idea that simplicity on this side of complexity is worth nothing, but simplicity on the other side of complexity is worth everything. Mm-hmm. And so, okay. So one of the reasons that simplification as a strategy is underutilized is because people just are satisfied with complexity. That took a lot of work to develop something that works, even though now it's really complex and isn't as smooth or as effortless for the user or as simple in its design. So, and I think that's a reasonably good argument for why people don't adopt it as a strategy, even though it's on display at Apple all of the time, right? Like, I think that's a reasonable explanation. It's one explanation. There's another piece though to the puzzle, because there's other versions of simplicity, even in an innovation cycle. Like, I think about Google search engine.
Yeah.
Like, that's just by default. That's just because like they didn't know what they were doing and they weren't designers and they just were like, okay, how do we program? I mean, that was simplicity out of necessity. Or perhaps a lack of almost ironically, a lack of design aesthetic. It's like, okay, we're just doing this thing, you know, we're just doing the minimum viable product to get this thing going. This is our skill level, whatever. Like, but that simplicity was an enormous advantage to them over the other consumer web solutions that were around at the time. It's a different kind of innovation through simplicity, but there's lots of examples of this.
Yeah, no, and it's great. And I think that's really important to point out. And sometimes that just like going right to simplicity, especially, is the best approach if you can do it, but it's hard to do. It's interesting you said the design aesthetic though, because I mean, if you think about, you may be familiar with Edward Tufte, he's like kind of the guru of information design. And one of his principles is to, what is it? Maximize the information to ink ratio, right? And I'm not saying like Google's font is right or anything like that, but in terms of the information to ink ratio, it's like, hey, here's what I need. Here's the box. Here's some branding. There's Google up there and go for it. So, I mean, the design aesthetic I think works, but yeah, I think that's a really good point that, you know, it's not the, there are other forms of simplicity that are sometimes called for. There are also some forms of, you know, just doing nothing is often called for, right? Like, hey, maybe we shouldn't be trying, if you're, you know, trying to solve some problem that doesn't actually matter, maybe doing nothing is the right approach. So, you know, subtraction is just like one of these classes of opportunities that we can try to make things better.
Yeah, but subtraction, but doing nothing is a subtraction. It's just before we make that thing, let's just decide if we need to do it. And Elon Musk describes a 5-step process for problem solving in an engineering context. And the first one is to question the requirements.
That's awesome, yeah.
So he's front-ending the simplification into the process. He's saying, and that actually, I think, is a non-trivial thing for us to explore for a moment, because this is one of the things that I found in researching Effortless, was that the master simplifiers seemed to come at the act of simplification in a different way to the amateurs. So like expert simplifiers were thinking of it from the very beginning in just the way that Musk is describing here, but it was also true for Jobs, and it was also true, you know, at Amazon with Bezos. And the principle, well, let me just give an example of it first. So when Amazon was first up and running, they had, let's say, 100 employees. They have a meeting to discuss the checkout process. And at the time, you know, maybe there's 28 clicks or something in the process. And they'd assigned a very capable engineer to think through that process and to simplify it, because the drop-off rate was extraordinary, right? And you can imagine e-commerce is brand new. I mean, even now you see the problem, mm-hmm. but at the time it was immense because people just felt so weird putting in their credit card and, you know, you have to put in each information and it was the first part of your address, click, next part, click, and so on. And so he worked on that problem for 2 months. He tried to simplify every step in the process. In a way, what we were just describing about this approach to simplification as the final thing, you know, let's now do a bit more than the less conscientious designer would do. But somewhere in that meeting where they finally were coming together, just the three of them talking about this, Bezos turns to him and says, look, I'm not talking about simplifying every step in the process. I'm talking about no process. I'm talking about, and this is how the one click selling comes to be. So he protects that for the next 20 years. You can argue, and people have argued that it was a bit unfair for Amazon to be able to maintain control of something so rudimentary. But when I spoke to the engineer who's no longer at Amazon, he told me that he completely defends Amazon's right to have that control, you know, for a period of time, like IP, because he said everyone was thinking about that problem the way I was. All of our competitors thought about it that way. Only Bezos had the insight that what we need is not to sort of streamline every step that we already have. It was, how do you eliminate all of those steps? And this idea, I came to think about this as start with zero, was exactly what Apple did with DVD, you know, the DVD burning software that he had, where they went from 5,000 pages to a simplified version. And he was like, no, I mean one step, one little rectangle and pull your content there and press burn. That's the app that he wanted. No one else thought like that. And so I'm curious about this, what your thoughts are about these competent subtractors who seem to just come at all problems with this simplification first thinking.
Yeah, it's almost like they're subtracting, they're taking on the kind of mental model, right, of this situation first and seeing if subtracting can be used there. I guess what I mean by that is like, yeah, you've got the 17 steps in the Amazon process, and that's the thing that you're trying to simplify. But before digging into the 17 steps, they're questioning the mental model of the whole purchasing process, right? And can we subtract from that? And I think that, as you know, not surprisingly, it's really, really hard to subtract from the things that we think already, right? There's a famous, one of my favorite psychology studies, this guy, Leon Festinger, he was studying this and basically trying to have evidence of like what happens to people when they're confronted with like very obvious evidence that something they thought isn't true. And so he joined a doomsday cult, and which is a brilliant premise for a study, because if you like, now you've got either you've got the evidence or you're in the cult, and when the doomsday mm-hmm. comes and you're covered. But so he, you know, what happened is people are waiting for the doomsday to come. The clock strikes midnight, nothing happens. They, you know, 5 minutes in, they're like still debating if that's the official clock of the doomsday, and then nothing happens. About 4 in the morning, the cult leader is like, well, look, we staved off the doomsday with our faith, right? And so rather than like change this belief that's so obviously true, you're kind of bending it around, right? And trying to fix the 17 steps or modifying the 17 steps, to go back to your example, versus just saying, hey, look, you know, my previous conception of this needs to be completely modified. I don't know if that's helpful at all, but I do think that there's a step there. You know, I talk about it in my book that like the first step is to subtract before you improve, right? Subtract from the your conception of the problem before you dig into looking at things that you might subtract.
For everybody listening, what is one thing that you heard today that you can put into action? And by that, I mean put into subtraction. You know, what's one thing that you can eliminate from your life, from the physical things around you. What's one idea that stands with you you can now implement to the benefit and simplification and subtraction so that you can learn to breathe again? What is one person that you can share this with? How can you continue this conversation now that this conversation has come to a close? Thank you. Really, thank you for listening.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.